Well, now a call for some radical changes to the way our governments operate, including possibly expanding cabinet to include outside expertise. From combating COVID to climate change action, plans for water reform, child poverty and the housing crisis, public policy attempts to solve myriad problems. So why do some policies succeed and others fail? And why do governments often struggle to implement policy? Our guests have spent years researching the policy-making process here and in Europe. Sonia Mazey is a Professor of Public Policy at the University of Canterbury and former Pro Vice-Chancellor at its College of Business and Law. Jeremy Richardson's an Adjunct Professor at the University of Canterbury and Emeritus Fellow at Nuffield College, Oxford. Their book, Policymaking Under Pressure, includes contributions from former government ministers, including Bill English and Leanne Dalzell, as well as senior public servants and political advisers to prime ministers, all seeking to answer the question, how can policy making and implementation be improved? Sonia and Jeremy, kia ora korua.
Kia ora. Kia ora.
Well, this pandemic response illustrated perhaps the best and worst of how government operates. Extraordinary and sweeping measures to protect lives and the economy on one hand, great frustration at what seems like obvious solutions not being implemented on the other. What are some of the key issues you've identified as a result of your work?
Well, I think the COVID response is a good example of one of the themes in the book, and that is that governments do not anticipate problems. They react to problems when they arise on the political agenda. And I think one expert before a parliamentary committee here in New Zealand, just after the start of COVID, said that we were caught with our pants down, that we were ill-prepared. But in that first response, we performed very well. So to use a footballing analogy, in the first half, we played an absolute blinder. We closed the borders. We went into a severe lockdown, the most severe in the world, probably, and did extremely well. And then when things got more complicated in the second half of the game, if you like, with MIQ and the vaccination program, the wheels have started to wobble, if not fall off. And I think that shows lack of detailed preparation, that many epidemiologists warned governments all around the world that there would be a pandemic at some point in time. We should prepare for it. Indeed, one New Zealand epidemiologist said to us that he had been preaching to empty halls for many, many years, that people didn't listen. And so I think this reactive policy style is the cause of many, many policy problems.
I think I would add to that, I'd agree with that, but also the implementation is extremely difficult of complex policy problems. Problems in a globalised society are inherently complex or wicked, and also there's a very long chain involved in getting policy from a proposal stage through Parliament, but then also implemented on the ground. It involves a lot of different actors, and I think one of the things we've seen with COVID is that actually it's really important that those stakeholders are consulted, they are involved in the co-design as well as the delivery of things like the vaccine rollout, including iwi, community groups, GPs. It can't all be run from Wellington by the Ministry of Health.
That gets heard over and over again in any number of situations, so let's talk about that. You had business and entrepreneurs putting forward what seemed to be solutions. Saga surrounding its saliva test is just one example. Others yeah. putting their hands up and saying we can do procurement better, we can tap into our networks. The separation between governments, being ministries and ministers, and everyone else, could you speak to that and how you see that could be finessed?
Well, I think there's got to be much more deliberation and much more consultation, that policies have got to be made at a much slower pace in a sense, that we rush to make solutions. And we voters are probably partly to blame. We expect the government to do something and do it now. And in the book, we quote an old saying, do you want it now or do you want it right? And I think we voters have got to be patient and let politicians take time to consult business or GPs or environmentalists. They need to consult people who, as we put it, know where the shoe pinches before they come forward with policies. So they need to be much, much slower, much more deliberative, and far more consultation as to what possible solutions are available How might they be implemented and how might they go wrong?
That go wrong is a really interesting question. Hearing from people, quite senior people within the public service, it has become extremely risk averse and very concerned at, you know, what would have been headlines in newspapers once. You can either see that as a disaster or you can see that as democracy working. Very concerned that anything that might make the minister look in a bad light. Is the risk aversion a real problem? Did anyone speak to you about it?
Yes, I mean, that came up for them, the relationship between ministers and public servants, the importance of trust, the importance of a good relationship, concerns on among ministers as well as among public servants about the Official Information Act, the advice that they might give might get into the public domain, anything that the senior politicians particularly might say, or the particularly party leaders during an election campaign, that becomes immediately interpreted as being policy. So there is a general nervousness, but it's also not a phenomenon that's limited to New Zealand.
Oh, no.
I mean, that there is an increasing, if you want, politicization, for the small p, of the public service across democracies. And of course, there's also now a networked fourth estate. So it is a very difficult environment for policymakers.
Also, I think worldwide, there's a trend for civil servants to do more ministerial bidding, whatever the minister wants. That's what the public or civil servants tend to do, rather than saying to the minister, this will not work for the following reasons. And Britain's a very good example of that, that under the Boris Johnson government, he's cleared out a whole generation of quite senior civil servants, because really they did say, well, minister, this is a really in private, this is a really daft idea. If you go down this route, disaster will follow. And people like that were pushed out under the Johnson government. And I think here in New Zealand, we've certainly not seen that happening at all. But I think there is a tendency for civil servants to feel that they are there to serve ministers. Now, of course, in one sense, that's exactly what they need to do. But we do need civil servants who will tell a minister, this is just stupid, you know, to have the ability to say that and warn the minister before disaster happens.
You do comment or have commented on the professional public service. Are we developing people to be at their best, to really build a body of expertise and to have that confidence to give the free and frank advice we expect them to?
Well, that's another recurring theme of the book in lots of ways, around the variable capacity and capability, analytical capacity and capability of our public service, compared to other countries where joining the graduate entry to the civil service, being a public servant, is a highly prestigious job. There was the Civil Service College in the UK, the graduate entry fast stream, again, NR in France, where they actually building that capacity and capability and of having a very strong public service that, or where technical expertise, scientific evidence, as well as policymaking, understanding the policymaking process, is highly valued. And one of the things that we've advocated for in the book really is that New Zealand might look overseas to how it might develop that capacity of its public service. Now, the Public Sector Act in 2020 does make some important recommendations about how we might do better at joined up interdepartmental policymaking. That at the moment, historically, we've been quite siloed in departments. So that's good and that's great. But I do think that we think there's a need for public servants and also ministers to have much more training, not just around what their particular sector, but in the policy process.
Did anyone talk to you about the burden of outputs versus outcomes? Outputs being almost a method of accounting required of public servants for the last 30 years or so. Because again, one hears criticisms that people are so busy fulfilling outputs that don't seem to be movable, even when they should be dumped. that again a lot of energy goes into things that maybe it ought not, and is diverted from things where maybe it ought to be.
Yeah, this is back to analytical capacity, I think, really, that we need more evidence-based policymaking. We need to look at what is actually working rather than just churning out more and more policies. And we need to be much more sophisticated, I think, to look at the implementation process and what's going right and what's going wrong.
Yeah, and actually, in terms of contributions to the book, Bill English actually does talk about the importance of what he calls feedback thinking, that there's a huge amount of data that is available. Actually, it's widely available to all of us in the public, so it's not something that civil servants just have privy to. But actually, there's no incentive, really, that we, because of the emphasis, as you say, on outputs rather than outcomes, that in fact there's no systematic, or systematic processes are quite weak and variable across sectors for reviewing the actual impact and re-steering and monitoring outputs, or looking at quite often policies are designed as a one size fits all, particularly in terms of welfare or public education, health, welfare, housing, whereas in fact people's lives are very different, and we could customize. So the private sector is quite good at customizing policy and outcomes, but actually the public sector is less good. So there's scope there, I think, for customizing outcomes.
And the vaccine rollout program, I think the problems with that illustrate perfectly Sonia's point, that we didn't really customize until more recently, the vaccine rollout program to take account of different groups of the population in New Zealand.
On that question, the pandemic has forced open in some ways the tight hold that government in the broadest sense holds over a lot of policy decision making and implementation. Business advisory groups have been set up to monitor what's happening, the likes of Sir Brian Roche and others.
Yes.
Scientists and professionals have been having reviews and commenting on the performance of a ministry. Is this a model that we could expand on going forward, because these problems, be it pandemics or climate or housing, are urgent and government doesn't seem to move fast enough?
Well, certainly bringing in a much wider range of actors in the policy process is extremely important. And I think in one chapter in our book by Peter Gluckman, the former chief scientific advisor to the government, makes the point that New Zealand is sort of very Wellington-based, and we live on the South Island, and we feel that too, having been here about 13 years. It's very Wellington dominated, and I think we do need to broaden the network of actors and organisations who are involved in the policy process, because there's a lot of knowledge and expertise. And you're right, we've seen it in the COVID response, the way governments have reached out to people like Professor Baker at Otago and the mathematical modellers and business groups. And it does illustrate that there's a lot of expertise outside government, and government needs to draw on that much more than it has done in the past.
What's the most radical thing you propose then? I think you do go so far, or have done in conversation, as to suggest perhaps cabinet should be able to co-opt expertise as it's needed to sit around that hallowed table.
Yes, that's certainly the most radical proposal I think we make, that we're saying that if you stand back and look at the selection and appointment of ministers, they have to be drawn from the governing party or governing parties in Parliament. It's a very, very small pool of talent, and that pool arrives in Parliament not because of their expertise in making public policy or analysing public policy. They get there for all sorts of reasons. So one of the most radical proposals that we put forward is that we should consider appointing ministers from outside Parliament. We should look around who knows about health policy, who could become Minister for Health. But those people would still have to be accountable to Parliament. They'd have to answer parliamentary questions in the normal way. They'd have to appear before parliamentary select committees and be grilled in the normal way. But they would come into office, they'd become ministers because of what they know about that particular policy area. Whereas Currently, sometimes a minister might know a lot about that policy area, but quite often they know absolutely nothing about that policy area. And I do admire how they manage, even the worst performing minister. I do admire them, the way they have to master a policy area that they knew absolutely nothing about on day one. And Catherine, then they have people like you quizzing them in great detail about the policy area, and they've just perhaps been a week in office, and I'm surprised they don't press the panic button.
Wonderful. We'll leave it there. Thanks. There's much to talk about. We may talk further, actually, because it is a really important time for government. We're going to be looking also at some of the accountability issues at the moment. Select committees being very short and rushed. Wide-ranging legislation like last week's traffic lights going through under urgency. It seems a time where we could have some good conversations around these things. So I hope you come back at some point. Thank you. Sonia Mazey and Jeremy Richardson, Policymaking Under Pressure is their book.